This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Wir sind zurück beim Spitzenspiel zwischen Einnahmen und Ausgaben. Es bleibt spannend. Gutschrift zu Bonus, Bonus und da taucht plötzlich Spesenerstattung auf. Schuss! Oh, in letzter Sekunde hält der Notgroschen.
Finanzen werden nie so spannend sein wie Fußball, aber wir geben unser Bestes. Konto, Geschäftskonto, Unternehmensgründung, Buchhaltung.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Picture a room full of charts, maps, whiteboards and reference books, and into it come the top experts who have half an hour to tell us what we most need to know about the things that matter. And that thing this week is Malta, the EU state where 2 years ago a journalist was assassinated in her car and where the investigatory trail has led right to the peak of the establishment. And if you enjoy this podcast, you'll probably like some of our other episodes, including ones on post-election taxes, meat-eating and Brexit. You can find them all on BBC Sounds. That was the background in Valletta on Monday, after the Prime Minister of Malta announced his resignation, and you may be thinking, I didn't even know Malta had a Prime Minister. And anyway, what's all that got to do with the price of fish? I want to know too. So step into the briefing room to discover why he's going, how it all began with the murder of a journalist, and why what is happening in its smallest state has such big implications for the European Union. Let's start with what happened just over 2 years ago. My first expert in the briefing room is Michael Peel, the EU diplomatic correspondent of the Financial Times.
In October 2017, the Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia was killed by a car bomb very shortly after leaving her home. Daphne Caruana Galizia was an extraordinary high-profile figure in this Mediterranean island state. She wrote a blog which was very closely followed, which ranged from waspish political commentary to exposés of alleged high-level political corruption. Her murder shocked Malta, and it shocked wider Europe as well, and it triggered an investigation and a political crisis which is only now starting to come to a head 2 years after she was killed.
What has happened in the last few days and weeks?
In November, a middleman was arrested. This is quite by chance, by the way. He was picked up for something else, but then started to divulge information in which he said that he'd acted as a middleman in this murder. And then it suddenly opened up the case, and he implicated one of the island's leading businessmen, who's a man named Jorgen Fennec, who was then arrested and very dramatically was on his luxury yacht sailing away from Malta when the authorities swooped. And he has now been charged with involvement in the murder, which he denies. He has in turn implicated various other people, and he has links, allegedly financial links, with quite senior officials in the government. So the major development now, after the emergence of this alleged middleman in the murder and his testimony, and now Mr. Fennec, the businessman, is trying to implicate other people, other government officials, when they deny involvement, including Mr. Shkembri, the former Prime Minister's Chief of Staff. But we're now in this situation where there are allegations and counter-allegations swirling around. And at the centre of it all sits a Prime Minister who, critics say, is completely conflicted in this case, and that it's unsustainable for him to remain in office. He was under great pressure. There were street protests night after night outside of the Baroque building in Valletta, the fortified capital that serves as his headquarters. And eventually he said that he would stand down, but not until January.
Michael Peel, and he'll be back a little later. But before delving deeper into the case and its implications, we first need to know more about Malta itself. So I asked David Aboulafia into the briefing room. He's Emeritus Professor of Mediterranean History at Cambridge University and author of an acclaimed book about the Med, The Great Sea.
One of the ways the Maltese like to see themselves is as sitting at the crossroads of the Mediterranean and seeing themselves as people who've been permeated with influences across the last, not just 1,000 years, but 4,000 years, influences coming from North Africa on the one hand and coming from Sicily and Italy on the other, but also much further afield. I mean, influences from Spain, influences from the Greek world and the Eastern Mediterranean. And that sort of sense that the whole of Mediterranean history comes together on these islands. And the role of Malta in the trade of the Mediterranean over the centuries has been actually relatively limited. And this might come as a surprise, because if you were to look at some of the other islands, if you were to look at Cyprus or Majorca or something, one of the things which would strike you immediately is how very important they were as entrepôts servicing trade across the Mediterranean, bringing in settlers from all the countries round about and so on. I think the problem for Malta has been it didn't have that much to offer. So really the importance of Malta has been much more its role as a defensive base. And if you go there, of course, that is the first thing that strikes you, that you come in, particularly if you were to come in by sea, the first thing you would see would be these massive fortifications on both sides of the Grand Harbour. It was really the great fort in the middle of the Mediterranean. That was what made it important.
Held by the French under Napoleon, in 1800, it became part of the British Empire.
Under British rule, Malta for a long time was rather neglected. There wasn't much interest at the British end in doing things for the islanders. They were colonial subjects. Don Mintoff, who eventually became a thorn in the flesh of the British government as Prime Minister of Malta, was known to be a great supporter of the idea of integration. But they didn't get the majority that they needed in order to push this through. And then it's not surprising that the independence movement began to gather pace after that. After independence, the Maltese decided that they wanted to do exactly what a number of former colonies did, which was to some extent to turn their back on their former colonial masters. And that did involve, in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, it involved, given the state of the world at that time, looking towards Russia and China and also southwards, due southwards, towards Gaddafi's Libya. So they built up some strange alliances under Mintoff. In fact, Malta became a sort of playground for rich Libyans who weren't allowed to drink at home and weren't allowed all sorts of other things. But this was also something which involved sort of playing with fire. So Mintoff, I think, sometimes forgot how small and vulnerable such a place could be.
So grand ideas, though its prime ministers might have had, Malta was always limited by being a little island with little influence in the world. But then the lure of the enlarging EU proved irresistible.
I remember talking to people from Malta years ago, long before they actually joined the European Union, saying this was their great aspiration. And also they adopted the euro, I think, really before they even had to do so. And from their point of view, it has been a great success. The Maltese economy, if you go back, let's say, 8 years, something like that, it was the one Mediterranean economy within the European Union that was booming. So I think from that perspective, they see the EU as something which has really lifted them far beyond their economic expectations.
Professor David Aboulafia, bringing us into the present. But now we need to go back to Michael Peel to flesh out the full story of the death of a journalist and what happened next.
A while back, three men had been arrested and accused of actually carrying out the murder.
By Maltese police?
Yes. They deny this, but in any case, there was no detail about the motivation or who was behind this.
Is it your view that the police investigation after the murder was slow?
Certainly, many people see it that way. It was over 2 years before it really started to come out. Any kind of detail and any kind of suggestions about what really lay behind this, i.e. beyond the mechanics of the murder and the people who actually carried out the hit. And, you know, the problem is that the police, whether this is fair or not, that the suspicion that always lingered over them was because of the political aspects to this case. The perception was that was compromising the integrity of the case, which has been one of the problems all the way through in this.
Is there a unity of opinion in Malta about what should happen and what to make of these events?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because it's important to set this in a bigger context, which is Joseph Muscat's Labour government has been in power since 2013. But before that, there were almost two decades of near unbroken rule by the Conservative Nationalist Party. And people who have analysed this, and you know, even fair-minded nationalists, will acknowledge that this is one of the reasons why this kind of culture of corruption, conflicts of interest and cronyism developed and became entrenched. But what people say is that the Muscat government, which came to power in 2013, was even more ruthless about testing and exploiting the system for patronage and cronyism. And that's deepened the problems that were already there.
How would that work?
Well, for example, if you have an electorate, you have a population of 500,000 people, of course, many of those are non-voters because they're too young, you certainly have a situation where you, by giving benefits to relatively small numbers of people, you can potentially influence quite large numbers of voters. And one of the controversies about the Muscat government was his opponents said, well, you know, he's offering sweeteners to the military, and this is partly about getting soldiers' votes. So it had a meaning beyond just, you know, higher defence spending. I mean, he denied that was corrupt, but you have this situation where a small intervention can yield quite big results. But one final sort of aspect which is worth bearing in mind, which is problematic, is that the Maltese authorities have the power to grant pardons to suspects in the case in exchange for information. Now, if the Prime Minister or other officials are involved in those decisions, that creates the potential for further conflict and further compromises of the investigation.
One of the other things which I think some people became aware of here relatively recently is that Malta sells passports, i.e. EU passports, his own passports, to outsiders.
That's right. Malta, according to a report earlier this year by the European Commission, is one of three countries that has so-called golden passport schemes. And basically this means that if you're a rich investor, you can buy nationality. And this has long been criticised by anti-corruption campaigners. And by the way, most of the EU, including big countries like Britain, offer residence visas for sale to rich investors. And of course, by acquiring residency, you may eventually be able to qualify for nationality.
Now, in the past, when we've heard about countries that the EU thinks it's having problems with, Malta wasn't one of them.
There's a whole anxiety gripping the EU about autocracy and a slide in the rule of law in some countries. And Joseph Muscat, the Maltese Prime Minister, is not like Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who goes to EU meetings, makes a fuss, is kind of combative. Malta's very much, you know, we're good, you know, members of the EU can count on us, and you know, it's not a consensus breaker. And so for those reasons, you know, his stock was quite high in Brussels. He perhaps didn't attract as much scrutiny as he should have done. And it's only lately that the new commission of Ursula von der Leyen has started to be a bit more public about raising concerns as the investigation moves into this new and more dramatic phase.
Michael Peel of the FT. The story of corruption reaches to the heart of what seems to have been a very popular government. So what are the Maltese people themselves making of what is unfolding? To find out, I invited Aldo Zamit Borda into the briefing room. He's Maltese and senior lecturer in international law at Anglia Ruskin University. Aldo Zamit Borda, why would somebody have wanted to kill Daphne Caruana Galizia?
Daphne Caruana Galizia was the most well-known investigative journalist in Malta. And while her writing critiqued various officials across the political spectrum in Malta, she focused especially on the ruling party, the Labour Party. that both in 2013 and in 2017 won elections with an overwhelming majority, so therefore has a huge support base in Malta. Therefore, from the beginning, Daphne was seen as an enemy of the party, and a smear campaign was put up against her and the writings.
A smear campaign? What kind of smears were they, and who was running them?
From various quarters of the Labour Party. Effectively, the narrative was that Daphne was seeking to undermine the gains and the good policies that the government was implementing. And let us face it, I mean, over the last few years, Malta has enjoyed significant economic prosperity and economic growth. So supporters of the Labour Party saw Daphne's journalism as undermining this growth, this prosperity, and seeking to undermine the government.
So are you saying that the Labour Party and the government managed to get a significant proportion of Malta's population to agree with them about what kind of person Daphne Caruana was?
Yes, I think so. Even in light of the developments in the last few weeks in Malta, that still remains the case. And I mean, I think this was evident just a few days ago in Malta, where you had two parallel demonstrations happening, one in front of Parliament where people were calling for accountability and an end to impunity, but at the same time you had a demonstration that was just as large in front of the Labour Party headquarters, demonstrating support for the government. So still in Malta, there is a significant proportion of people who consider the narrative that there is corruption or alleged bribery and such practices to be unfounded.
Do they genuinely believe it to be unfounded? Or do they think it may be founded, but they still would prefer the Labour government and everything that goes with it, the prosperity and so on?
Daphne served to uncover a number of scandals and alleged corruption. With some very small exceptions, these have never been investigated by any inquiry or judge. So therefore, up until this point, nobody can say with any degree of certainty that they are founded.
In other words, there was sufficient ambiguity for people who wanted to dismiss them to be able to do so.
Absolutely. And that is the crux, I think, of the issue that we are in at the moment. She did point to some telling circumstantial evidence which, at the very least, merited investigation. But rather than doing so, the government simply swept them under the carpet.
And swept them under the carpet with the support of a section of the Maltese people.
Absolutely, with a section of a significant support of the Maltese people.
Let's take your picture of a Malta that is divided between support for investigation and support for the Labour Party. Now, if you are in favour of investigation and proper and due process of law, that's a fairly obvious stance to take. You can see where it leads. But if you're demonstrating for the other thing, do those people think that they are demonstrating in favour of impunity and corruption?
No.
So what do they want?
So there are two competing narratives over here. As you say, one is in relation to independent, impartial investigations to look into these allegations of corruption. If someone is writing lies, it is unlikely that someone would be so motivated as to order the killing, the assassination of a journalist, right? But in terms of the other camp, those who have taken the view that the actions that were started by Daphne and are now being pursued by those who are demanding impunity are simply actions aimed at undermining the Labour government, undermining its leadership and its support base.
Do you think Maltese are aware of people now looking at them in a particular way, and does that worry them?
Yes, Maltese are becoming more and more aware that they are in the international spotlight. You've had just a few days ago mission from the European Parliament visit. You've had also the European Commission make some questions and also the Council of Europe. And I think that's absolutely really important, particularly in a small country such as Malta, where, of course, most of the people involved in the allegations are actually those in government. I visited Daphne Caruana Galizia's last post before she was murdered yesterday. Her blog is still online. She finished her last blog with the following words: "There are crooks everywhere you look now. The situation is desperate." And of course, those last words ring particularly ominous and true today, as they did when she wrote them.
Aldo Zamit Border. But Malta being in the EU, what happens on the island doesn't stay on the island. How has the union reacted to this story of corruption at the highest level? I'm joined down the line from Brussels by Heather Graby, director of the think tank the Open Society European Policy Institute. Heather Graby, how worried is the European Union about this stuff in Malta?
It's becoming increasingly worried because this is now not only a case involving murder and of an investigative journalist, but it follows several others. Remember that last year, two other journalists were killed in other EU member states. There was Jan Kuciak in Slovakia and Victoria Marinova in Bulgaria. And that's something that we're used to hearing about from places like Russia, but inside the European Union is pretty shocking. Plus, the way that the investigations that have now been going on show the problems with lack of independence of the judiciary and also issues around governance, really, in an EU member state, that's causing real ructions because this is now a Mediterranean country which is joining some of the Central European countries, namely Hungary and Poland and Romania as well, which are showing quite serious problems with different parts of their democracies, constitutional setups, and especially rule of law. And the EU is a community of law. That is what underpins all of the mutual trust, all of the single market, all of the cooperation between member states. So if the rule of law is eroded, then everything else doesn't work. It's about independence of the judiciary and of the police, but it's also related to separation of powers and whether the EU as a whole, whether all of the other member states can rely on a country's internal constitutional setup and separation of powers to function properly. And historically, the EU has not wanted to get involved in these matters because its member states didn't want that. Contrary to the stereotype you sometimes hear about the federalized superstate, in fact, the EU's powers are very limited in areas outside its core competences of the single market, of trade policy, of competition policy. Remember, it was set up as a common market and everything else has grown out from that. It was never set up as an organisation which was supposed to check up on what was going on in the internal affairs of its member states.
Has Malta's size had anything to do with it? I suppose what I'm asking is, if the same thing had happened in France, would people have taken a lot more notice of it than they did because it happened in Malta?
I think what's interesting here is the EU's ambivalent attitude towards the size of member states. There's generally speaking a kind of culture of let's not bully small countries. Germany especially has always been very careful to maintain a norm at EU level of ensuring everybody is included. But there's also with it a bit of a sense of, well, how much does this country, is it really going to matter? Yes, there are problems here, but is that really going to affect the rest of the union? Is it really going to spill over into other countries? So I think size does have an effect to some extent, but this particular case really drew a lot of attention and there have been concerns about it from the very beginning.
You posed the question of how a situation in Malta or somewhere else, showing as it does that the rule of law is deficient, might be said to have some kind of knock-on effect for EU countries. Now, what about the reputational effect upon the European Union? In other words, its claim to be a club of countries that behave in a certain sort of a way.
Yes, it has a huge impact on the EU's reputation and credibility in the rest of the world, because the EU has always sought as an external actor in the rest of the world to be a normative actor, to use its soft power, to promote values. And so it's quite awkward for EU diplomats and indeed ministers from the member states and so on going to visit other parts of the world and talking about the importance of media pluralism and press freedom if there are problems at home. So the embarrassment factor is large, especially because This case in Malta has come after all kinds of problems with freedom of the press in Hungary and increasingly pressure on the press in Poland. And the new Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, has given a specific mandate now to two of the new commissioners, particularly Vera Jourova, who's the Commissioner for EU Values and Democracy, as well as Didier Reynders, who's responsible for rule of law, to look at press freedom very specifically in their assessments of how member states respect EU democratic values. So this idea of monitoring and actually looking into it in more detail has come up much more strongly now.
Now, that's very interesting, but it sets it in the context of press freedom. That's obviously incredibly important. But in Malta, arguably, what you have is a problem of criminality at the highest level.
Remember that the EU was not set up to look at things like organised crime. It's a bolt-on. It's something that came later. And the EU's powers to investigate itself are more or less non-existent. There is now a European Public Prosecutor's Office, which is about to start work. But its powers are limited to investigating fraud and corruption offences or allegations involving EU money, not involving what goes on in a member state. So there isn't by any means an EU police force or even an EU public prosecutor which can look at these kinds of issues in a member state.
Or even EU sanctions.
No, the sanctions would only really apply through a much bigger procedure called the Article 7 procedure. It's from Article 7 of the Treaty on European Union, which essentially addresses breaches of the EU's values. Clearly, there are breaches of the EU's values in a case involving press freedom, corruption, and also organised crime. But the usage of this article is really tricky. It requires unanimity among the member states to impose any kind of sanction. And before getting to sanctions, which would be basically about suspending voting rights, there's a very long procedure. And member states are very reluctant to use it because of the Gentlemen's Club. They're thinking, well, do we really want lots of scrutiny of our peers under this procedure? And so with huge reluctance, they've started looking at it with regard to Poland. The European Parliament has put forward Article 7 on Hungary, but there's really little enthusiasm to use it. It's seen as the nuclear option.
Heather Graby, what do you think is likely to happen now?
Over the next few years, there are going to be a lot of initiatives put forward by the various EU institutions to tackle this problem with rule of law, because there's now a much more alarm about the effect it's having on the whole union. So I think what's likely to happen is that the Commission's proposal to impose conditions in the EU budget is likely to move forward. And that would mean that if a member state was found to have deficiencies in the rule of law, then its funds could be restricted. Also, the European Public Prosecutor's Office, the powers could be expanded to include investigation of serious cross-border corruption allegations. I think it's very likely that there will be more on monitoring, because so far the Commission has been quite cautious about this because member states don't want it messing around in their underwear drawer. But there is a need to backfill the big gap at the moment in EU law, where the EU has a treaty that says, here are our values, we're going to defend them, these values are really important to us. And then it's got no legal mechanisms, nothing that sets out exactly what these values mean in detailed legal provisions, and no enforcement capacity for them. And so the gap between the rhetoric and the reality is becoming very urgent to fill. And that's why I think the European Parliament will be pressing very hard for faster measures. The Commission is gearing up to introduce maybe even more legislation in this area.
Heather Graby. So, what can we conclude from all this? That this is the mother of all scandals and that the EU is not set up to deal with cases like it, but increasingly it knows it has to and is edging towards taking the necessary powers, the trouble being that some governments just don't want it to. My thanks to Michael Peel, David Abulafia, Aldo Zamit Border, and Heather Graby. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Jordan Dunbar and Simon Coates. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Hi, I'm Hugh Dennis. For many of you, the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal is as familiar as Christmas trees and tinsel. Radio 4 listeners have long supported St Martin in the Fields to help thousands of people away from homelessness. And once again, we're asking you to help people across the UK find a safe, secure home. Please support the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields by donating online on the Radio 4 website. Whether you're a long-standing donor or this is your first year, thank you. Home starts here.